So this morning I want to comment on all three of our readings to try to help us listen to them as wisdom for the Advent Revolution, for saying no to the culture of now in order to have the joy of recognizing and embracing the work of God in us and around us. I think I mentioned a week or so ago that I've been reading a book by Michael Harris, who I'm sure none of you will have heard of. He wrote a book called Absence. He's really a tech guy who was a journalist and wrote for a lot of tech journals and wrote books and stuff. And I just came across it somehow and been reading it. And so I want to take string together some quotes here that arise from one of the chapters, I think maybe it's chapter 5, to give this sort of composite picture of what this author is trying to describe. In order to escape my actual dull life, I'm often looking for a heightened or augmented form of reality, but I'm learning that my screen time is wreaking havoc on my sense of the authentic. I feel like I need to pull away from screens to hear the valuable stuff underneath the swarm of noise that blankets my life. I notice, he said, that when I'm frustrated, miserable, or feeling thwarted in some way, I tend to go to my inbox or Twitter feed or Instagram more often, thinking that unopened messages are always the best because they hold the promise of stimulation, the jolt of hope that I might receive something wonderful to color my otherwise gray world. I'm turning into a stimulus junkie. I know God wired my brain to be able to focus, but I go for pure distraction. I used to be able to read, but now I think my brain has been rewired by checking my devices so often that I can't concentrate on anything or do anything that requires sustained mental effort. If I focus on only one thing, I always feel like I'm missing out on something important. This seems very hard to fix, the author says, and I'm becoming more and more distracted. I am leaking so much concentration that I'm getting less and less important stuff done. It takes a week or so for withdrawal symptoms to work through a heroin addict's body. I think, the author said, it's going to take some work to deprive myself from the manic digital distractions I've grown addicted to. So that's just a little composite. I'm not sure how much that would describe us, and that's only thinking about the craziness of human life from one aspect. There's 19 other aspects, facets of life through which we could think about it. But I just want to help us this morning wonder, as we just take some steps through these passages, just this one simple question. What intelligent, grace-enabled steps might we take to joyfully be able to hear and see God in our lives? So let's begin with the psalm, if you want to look there. This psalm is describing a past event of salvation which gives hope in the present. So when the psalmist says, when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dreamed, who were filled with joy. And so now, Lord, in this time of stress, do it again, restore our fortunes. So the times of anxiousness that the psalmist is talking about could be the kind of anxiety caused by sin, by suffering, by some need for personal growth in our lives, or for just looking for a sign of God's promise in some dark or hard time. And this is important to us, I think, in the sense of Advent waiting, because at least for me, I noticed that in moments of human vulnerability, in moments of human uncertainty, the God of creation that we just, you know, studied all through Genesis in ordinary time, and the God of covenant, that God can seem remote. And when God seems really remote, for most of us, our default positions is to fall back into worry and nervousness. And of course, the iconic moment for this in the Bible is when Israel as a whole is nervous and anxious about what's going on. And so they create a god. They create an idol. They create a golden calf. And Walter Brueggemann, you know, with his book we've been reading together, Sabbath as Resistance, Brueggemann says that God or idol making amid human anxiety is standard procedure. It's just what humans do. When the God, the one true God, the one Lord, creator, sustainer of the earth seems distant, then the standard human procedure is to then create a God that they can make be near to them. And the big bummer is, a God of our creation is not the God of creation. And they can't really help. That is the great, unfortunate deception of idols. They don't work. And so the invitation of this psalm is, hey, remember what you learned in Sinai. You can let go of the angsty fretfulness that comes from a loss of confidence in the reliability of the Creator and the goodness of creation. For when we begin to lose confidence in God, we then can begin to think that the goal of life is acquiring things or being able to have the gold to make this God. And the invitation of the psalm this morning, and the reason it comes to us in Advent, is an invitation to remember the Exodus, that you were once a slave. And if you forget this, you will give yourself over to an alien identity of coercive production and anxious consumption. And so the psalm wants to sort of pull us back and to ask us, hey, why don't you do this instead? Situate yourself in the alternative of the kingdom of God. Free yourself from the matrix of Pharaoh, knowing that God will restore you, and never any idol that we make. Now, we could take this passage. I'm going to read to you a rather lengthy quote from Jesus. And this is not like hyperbole. I mean this. We could sit with this for a year. We could do 52 Sundays of just sitting with this. Don't hoard treasure down here, where it gets eaten by moth and corroded by rust or stolen by burglars. Stockpile treasure in heaven, where it's safe from moth and rust and burglars. It's obvious, isn't it? The place where your treasure is the place where you will most want to be and will end up being. If you decide for God, living a life of God worship, it follows that you won't fuss over what's on the table at mealtimes or whether the clothes in your closet are in fashion. There's far more to your life than the food you put in your stomach, more to your outer appearance than the clothes you hang on your body. Has anyone, by fussing in front of the mirror, ever gotten taller by so much as even an inch? All this time and money wasted on fashion, do you think it makes that much difference? Instead of looking at all the fashions, walk out in the fields and look at the wildflowers. See what the Creator God has fashioned and sustained for more millennia than we can know. Whether you're a new earth person or an old earth person or somewhere in between, those flowers come stunningly every spring. They never primp or shop, but have you ever seen the color and the exquisite design? Anything like it? The 10 best men and women in the country look shabby alongside them. Now here's the punchline. This is Jesus, right? This is not a moral philosopher. It's not Plato or Aristotle. This is not a great ethicist. This is the one you call Lord and say that you want to follow. If God gives such attention to the appearance of wildflowers, most of which are never even seen, don't you think he'll attend to you, take pride in you, do his best for you? And this is where I would just so covet. I mean, this has been my dream for starting this church. This has been my dream for all of Orange County. I grew up here. This is my home. Jesus said, here's what I'm trying to get you to do. I want you to learn to relax. I'm tired of the fretfulness in my creation, I can hear God saying. I'm tired of its soul-destroying energy. I'm sick of what it does to families, the anti-neighborliness it creates in corporations. Tired of it. What I want to get you to do is just relax, to not be so preoccupied with getting that you can respond to God's giving. It's people who don't know God and the way he works that fusses over these things, but you know both God and how he works. So then here's the invitation. This is the Advent invitation. So then steep your life in God reality, in God initiative, in God provisions. Don't worry about missing out. Give your entire attention to what God is doing right now, and you'll find all your everyday concerns will be met. It's a great passage in John 6 when Jesus has been saying crazy stuff like that. That kind of crazy stuff that Jesus says sometimes. Crazy. No one believes it. It's crazy talk. There's a place like that in John 6 where Jesus has been saying crazy stuff like that. Stuff about how he, his body, his blood, that's what actually nourishes the human being. And Jesus looked at a crowd of people and he said, "You don't believe in me." Except he doesn't say that. He leaves out that those two letters that every evangelical, you know, wants to put all their weight on. You don't believe in me. Jesus doesn't say that. You know what he says? You don't believe me. You hear me. Blah, blah, blah. But you don't actually believe me enough to place your confidence in what I say corresponds to reality. That there is God initiation, God provision. Steep yourself in it. And when you do, you will find freedom that will allow you. I mean, it's a bit of a ground level word, but I'm okay with that in this case. It will allow you to relax. I mean, if you want me to talk about it on a little higher level, how would you like a little more emotional energy? How would your wife maybe like you to have a little more emotional energy? How would you like to have a little more, you know, spiritual energy to, you know, deal with life as it comes your way? Well, that can't come out of an angsty sort of, I've got to provide for myself, because then all of your emotional, spiritual, and intellectual energy is taken up on that. And so we have families the way we have families, and businesses the way we have businesses, and neighborhoods the way we have neighborhoods, because I'm not sure anybody actually believes this. And so it's important to say that this is not a moralism. Jesus is not being an ethicist. This transcends moral theology, moral philosophy. This trans ethicists. This is a new reality that's meant to allow human pause and rest and Sabbath. This in turn teaches us to live our other 6 days differently. When this kind of relaxedness, as Peterson puts it in the message, comes to us, then there comes on the heels of that the kind of emotional and spiritual energy I'm describing. So the fundamental invitation here, the Advent invitation, is this: to a life of peaceableness, a life that is Sabbathed, to invent a word. And I don't just mean what do you do on Saturday or Sunday. I mean building into your life that kind of Sabbathness. Versus rat race living. That's the invitation. So then we return to Paul and to our New Testament reading this morning. Paul says these big things, you know, give thanks to God in all circumstances. This is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. Don't quench the Spirit. Hold to what's good. Reject every kind of evil. And then may the God of peace sanctify you through and through, your whole spirit, soul, and body. May it be kept blameless at the coming of the Lord. You hear the Advent waiting there. Beth introduced us to as we started this morning. You hear that Advent waiting. Well, again, this is not Paul being a moral theologian. This is a discourse on the good life. This is how Peterson gets Jesus saying relaxed confidence in the provision of God. This is a discourse from Paul on what comprises the good life. And Paul wants to say that it's a completeness and wholeness in God that makes up the good life. But what Brueggemann, and what, you know, we've been reading in his book on Sabbath as resistance, he reminds us that we've got all kinds of substitutes for a Sabbathed life. And normally they're stimulants. And these stimulants mar the work of God. They create a whirlwind in which the wind of the Spirit or the breath of the Spirit is marginalized. So again, I want to say you cannot hear this as an ethic. This is not an ethic on moderation. This is not a moral talk telling us how to live. This is Paul deeply and profoundly reflecting on comprehensive devotion, on unreserved and all-consuming self-giving to God that makes up the Christian life. This is what Paul means, that your whole body and soul, your spirit, your mind, your will, all these particulars that we think make up the human person, that they would all come into this devotion of blessedness and taken care ofness by God. This then allows us to be present to God and his action in our lives. Lastly, we come to our gospel reading, that John came as a witness, came to show everyone where to look, who to believe in. John said he was not the light, that he was here to show the way to the light, and that he was doing this that all might believe in Jesus through him. He said of himself, he was a voice crying out in the wilderness, quoting Isaiah, "I'm calling God's people to make straight the way of the Lord." And I think what we see in this that I think has the potential for human freedom is that John lets us know in this that he's not an independent person, that he's not trying to create a self on social media or climbing the corporate ladder or whatever. He's not trying to find himself in production or in consumerism, but rather he's living in a sense of story. He connects what he's doing to this long, deep, rich story of Israel. This is what actually shapes his imagination. I wonder if you just stopped for a second here right now this morning and asked yourself, what is it that shapes my imagination? What is it that gives me my sense of myself? What makes all the disparate aspects of my life cohere? All these things, what makes them cohere? Is there anything in my life, like a warm, comfortable hoodie, zipper on the front, that just zips up all the elements of my life? Is there anything around which I can make my life cohere? And without it, there is no peaceableness. There is no groundedness. There is no capacity. You cannot be an interdependent person of grace and goodness and hospitality and generosity if you don't have some sort of inner zipped upness that allows you a place to stand. Otherwise, we're just always using everybody else around us. This is the anti-neighborliness that Brueggemann's talking about. When life is reduced to nothing but production and consumption, there are no neighbors. There are just people for us to use so that from someone else we might be able to find a place to stand. Well, the reason John could be so helpfully interdependent and so useful to God is that he was not trying to create a self for himself. He had found a self in God, and knew that he stood in this sort of pivotal point in human history connected to what God was doing in ancient Israel and also pointing to the way to the fulfillment of all that. And so he's not trying to create a self. He's found a self in God. He's living in this sense of story from which he derives his sense of self, his sense of place, his sense of role. So what if we ended this morning where we started? That one person story I read to you from Absence, where this author, you know, describes the kind of wilderness he was describing. And as he reflected on it, he said of himself, "I think it's going to take some work to deprive myself of whatever it might be for you of my normal responses to life." So John then quotes Isaiah, and he really gives us an Advent command. He says, in the wilderness, and this is a command, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight paths. And now here is where I've got to bring this full circle and say to those of you who find issues of morality or character formation scary or off-putting or however, you know, you might find that, I just have to be honest with you and say this is a direct call to a moral reformation. This is an absolute, straightforward, direct call for character formation. The imagery here is roads that were full of boulders, full of huge potholes. And so the image of Isaiah that John is here borrowing when he gives us this command, this Advent command to prepare the way of the Lord, is to remove the big boulders and fill up the big potholes. And that is a physical analogy for the boulders that are in our hearts that keep us from connecting deeply to confidence in God so that we actually do believe him, and filling up the low places where we bang the bottom of our car, knock the front end out of alignment, and we can't drive straight. This is a direct, absolute, clear call to not do more. This is all highly nuanced stuff, and I want you to really try to get this. It's not a call so much to do more to connect with joy to God, but simply to remove things so that we can receive what's already been done on our behalf. Yesterday when it was, you know, done raining and it was so bright and shiny, you can remember yesterday afternoon how beautiful it can be here after it's rained. I walked into my bedroom and past a window, bright light, bright rays of light were shining down through the window. And I had this amazing moment where I flashed back to probably a 4 or 5 year old kid. Do you remember the first time you stood in front of a window and light was shining down and you saw the little flecks of dust? They're always in the air. They're in the air right now. They're all around us. You just can't see them. And I walked by and I saw these little particles of dust. Of course, I'd, you know, been preparing this, and I thought, this is the invitation from John. It's not go get moral so that you can make something happen. It's no, it's remove these boulders, you know, level this ground because there's something happening around you all the time. Prepare your hearts to receive it. That's the invitation here. And that's what keeps us out of the ditch of mere moralisms on the one hand, or a kind of, well, you know, moral and character things don't matter on the other. It's not something we produce, it's something that we just simply connect with. And this is why we read these passages in Advent, and it's why I wanted to take these moments this morning to say, then, the accent of Advent, I want you to just hear these words. Our waiting on Christ. Just hear those four words, our waiting on Christ. Where's the accent? Our waiting on Christ? Or is the accent our waiting on Christ? The Advent accent is not on us. The Advent accent is that we're already living a part of this huge story, but we're so distracted, so fragmented in our heads, so increasingly unable to concentrate on anything important that we just can't really see it except for those rare moments when there's this bright shaft of light and we see what's always already there. So for our quiet moment this morning, I wonder if we might wonder together for a sense of absence, for a sense of getting boulders out of the way. What might the Spirit be nudging you to remove this Advent that you can see the joy of Christ that's always already there? What might the Spirit be nudging you to remove this Advent to find the joy of Christ that's always already there?